event sponsored by the WSU chapter of the American Association of University Professors, and we're delighted to have you here. We are a new organization, or I should say a revitalized organization on campus as of last year. And I'm Judy Hugh, and I'm the co-president with Charlotte Omoto. And we are growing on campus. Faculty and graduate students are talking. They're raising issues of concern about the university and higher education in general. And that's one of the reasons we're so excited to have Dr. Gary Rhodes here, because he's working on these issues. This is his professional area and has been for quite a while. He's now the general secretary for the National AAUP, so he's right in the thick of things at this point. He's also the director of the Center for Higher Education at the University of Arizona, and he's a professor there. Dr. Rhodes holds a BA, MA, and PhD degree from sociology from the University of California at Los Angeles. His
I got stuck in a groove.
I did too.
I was there as a postdoc too. I violated all the rules, broadening my horizons.
His internationally recognized work includes two scholarly books and numerous articles on faculty restructuring, conditions of part-time faculty, politics of unionization, and intellectual property rights. He's also the former president of the Association for the Study of Higher Education, and he's worked with the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association, as well as AAUP. And throughout Dr. Rhodes' work, he's been an ardent supporter, as well as a scholar, for shared governance, for due process rights, for tenure track and contingent faculty, and for graduate employees as well. He's consistently criticized the ideological and functionary switch from viewing education as a public good to a private, market-driven purchase. And thinking about what that switch means for students, for faculty, for communities at large. So we are very excited to have Dr. Rhodes with us and happy to welcome you. Please come on, Rhodes.
Gary. As you can see, so I've been based in D.C. I started this position in January of last year. And D.C. is a wonderful town, nice place, gorgeous weather. But you can see from this overhead or this PowerPoint slide that I'm having separation issues from the southwestern Sonora Desert. So part of what I want to introduce myself is very much the way that Judy did. And first let me thank Judy and Charlotte and Rich and others for hosting me, and thanks to Kelly Ward for triggering all of this by asking a few questions at our ASH meeting about the AAUP. What I want to emphasize is I'm coming to you not only as this strangely titled General Secretary, more secretary than general. I don't have a whole lot of troops at my disposal, but also as someone who's been studying this stuff, as I tell my two daughters, much to their chagrin, for 25 years. And so a lot of what I'm bringing to this is not simply sort of AAUP policy and standards, but 25 years of scholarship and interviews with faculty and deans and provosts, and 25 years of living this stuff myself as a faculty member, all those years at the University of Arizona. So I get in a place and I like it and I stay. Now, like a good academic, I've changed the title. So I've done a little bait and switch on you. Moving target is harder to hit. Same basic theme. And also, like a good academic, of course, my title has either a colon or a semicolon. So I want to talk about how to build a saga, an organizational saga, for the public good. And in that, I want to emphasize the need for an independent faculty voice. And I'm going to use that language more than simply shared governance, because in a lot of places we're in the process, and I think you are here as well, of sort of negotiating what your traditional shared governance structures mean for the current decision-making processes that are taking place in your university. So, you know, typically we think of shared governance as we have a Senate and we have involvement in hiring of senior academic administrators, and we have involvement in hiring of colleagues. But shared governance is sort of, in some places, and I'm going to speak about this a little bit, in some places has come to be a little less substantial than maybe some faculty would like. And I think what I gather in this place is that you have some folks, both in the AUP chapter and beyond, who've been very active in a faculty senate that has had some substantial input and gets listened to on some things, and probably are in the process of negotiating. So what is that, what is the role of that body in the kinds of things that you're experiencing now that's happening nationally? All right. So briefly, as Judy introduced me, my work as a scholar is largely about the restructuring of higher education institutions, and I've been doing this for 25 years, and somehow every year it's a timely topic. So from the time I started in the mid-80s, all this talk about restructuring, about reallocation, reduction, retrenchment, there's a book that came out by that title in the early 80s, continued to be significant in the 90s. When I had a grant, I was telling someone here earlier today, I think maybe it was Rich, about this NSF grant I had studying department heads and faculty members, especially in science and engineering. How are you coping with tough economic times? That was in the mid-90s, and it continues to be relevant today, this topic. So I write a lot about that. I also write a lot about and gather data on the restructuring of professions and professional employment in higher education, which I'll say some about. As a field, this thing called higher education, it's confusing. You sit on an airplane and someone says, so what do you do? I'm a professor. What are you a professor of? Well, I'm higher education. Yeah, I know you're in a university, but what are you a professor of? So I end up saying, well, I'm a sociologist, but I'm in an ed school, and I'm in this program called higher education, which is an interdisciplinary field of people who study colleges and universities and student development and persistence and graduation, and they do institutional research. And in fact, one of my former students is here in institutional research. I ran into another former student earlier today, Al Jamieson, who was in student affairs here for years. So this is a field that is interdisciplinary. We do institutional research. We analyze policy and practice, and that's what we do. What about the AUP? What is the AUP? And let me just give you like a couple minutes to give you a sense of my interpretation of what the AUP is about. So we're coming up on our centennial. It was formed in 1915 by John Dewey and a series of other colleagues, really relatively small number of faculty members in the early 1900s who were pretty upset about celebrated firings of faculty members by institutions, kind of at the behest of boards that were upset about some of the work and the comments that these professors were making in their scholarly work, but also in the external world. One of the most celebrated folks was Scott Nearing. Anybody here heard of Scott Nearing? So what do you know about Scott Nearing?
He was married to Helen.
That's good. What else might we know about Scott Nearing? In the back, you were nodding your head. Scott Nearing. No? Okay. So Scott Nearing was a progressive reformer in the early 1900s. He was an economics professor at UPenn. And one of the things that he did, he was a pacifist, he worked against child labor, so he wrote this book called The Problem of Child Labor. Well, in the early 1900s, to the Board of Trustees of the University of Pennsylvania, child labor was not a problem. It was a mechanism for achieving efficient industrial productivity. And so he, as quite an active person, just ran afoul, essentially, of the Board of Penn and was dismissed. That was one of the first cases that this American Association of University Professors investigated and said, we need to begin to establish as part of the working conditions of faculty members the idea that they have academic freedom to pursue in their teaching and in their research and in their extramural speech when they're participating as public citizens to speak their mind. So this association really helped establish that concept of academic freedom in the U.S. and build it into handbooks and contracts of faculty. It also really built into our structure of employment, the institution of tenure, and as well it built into our conceptions the idea of shared governance, that faculty should be jointly engaged in shaping decision-making of the institution. Not that they should make the decisions, but that they should be closely involved in the consultative activity on a range of issues, really, especially primarily on academic issues, but also on financial issues. And so what we do now, having survived for 95 years and is really achieving, I think, the remarkable accomplishment of a small group of faculty embedding this stuff in our consciousness. We entertain inquiries from faculty who come to us with problems that they're having on their campuses. We establish a variety of policies and regulation, recommended regulations that we communicate with institutions about and encourage them to build into their handbooks. We file amicus briefs. We get engaged in, most recently, we worked with the ACLU to end ideological exclusion with regard to international scholars coming to the U.S. and giving talks. And we also provide, as much as possible, a variety of information about the finances and other sort of challenges facing higher education today, the various faculty groups into chapters. And really what the AUP is 47,000 people who are like Judy and Rich and Charlotte and others in this room, faculty members who care about their organization, who care about the academy, and who are trying to contribute to its enhancement by inscribing in that academy the principles and the policies and sort of the spirit of the association, which we all see as beneficial not only to the faculty, it's not just about perks, it's beneficial to the institution that we're involved in shared governance. It's beneficial to the institution and to the education of students that we have the freedom to pursue ideas in the classroom and in our research. So let me talk a little bit about the prevailing path that we're on and what I see as some of its pitfalls. And I'll kind of go through the three bullets, touch the fourth one. I do threes a lot because I'm the son of a Christian theologian, so this pulpit's good. A lot of trilogies. First is the reduction over the past 25 or 30 years in the professorial role in governance, but also in a range of academic work. So the more and more that we get ramped up in terms of having to be more productive in our teaching, more productive in our research, the less time we have to engage in the kinds of shared governance activities that we think are so important. And over the past 25 years, as I'll talk about, there's been more and more of a push to have more sort of aggressive steering from the center of the institution and a little less involvement from faculty governance bodies. And in fact, not eliminating those bodies, but setting up alternative bodies, which in a sense end run the traditional mechanisms of academic governance. So you have a strategic planning committee, which engages in strategic planning, even though you have an academic senate, which has a lot of responsibility for academic affairs and academic programs and the like. That's very typical in universities nationally. Second pattern is a reducing our possibilities in the fulfillment of our public missions. Because over 25 years, what has happened systematically, especially in public higher education, is an effort to imitate a private model. That's what becoming an AAU institution means, imitating a private model. Charging higher and higher tuition, so the president just got a license to be able to charge higher tuition. It's already been at 7% for 8 years, 14% one of those years, and I guess you're considering 14% now. The last time I checked, that's just a little bit above the cost of living increases for the past decade, right? And pretty considerably above the increases in faculty salaries as well. That's pretty typical. Generating more revenue from the students, being more entrepreneurial and trying to generate revenue from grants, although, as I'll say later, we're not very good accountants. We talk about how much money we bring in. We don't talk about how much money it costs to bring that money in. The best example of that, you don't have a medical school, although I gather you might be considering one at some point. They are extremely costly in net terms. They bring in money, but preparing medical students and having a medical school is an extremely expensive proposition. You have a very successful grant unit, as I understand it, in the College of Science. It's often the case that's found in research universities nationally, But I also understand that in your Faculty of Science, as is sometimes the case in faculties of engineering, that that unit's actually running a deficit. How could that be? There's a lot of cost that goes into getting those grants. There's a lot of matching grants, there's a lot of equipment grants, there's a lot of bridge grants, there's a lot of investment in facilities. So we're not really good accountants, but we increasingly emphasize a sort of entrepreneurial notion that we're going to generate our own revenues and not have to rely upon the state for funding. The corollary of all this is the third bullet, which is we get reduced public support. It becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The state looks at, sees the tuition going up, it sees the grant money coming in, sees us paying attention to being global players and probably a little less concerned with being local and regional players, and it wonders, so why are we giving so much money to you guys? And it responds as well to presidents who for 25 years have been talking increasingly about being not state universities, but state-assisted universities, and then it became state-located universities, and then sort of in the parlance, it becomes state-abused universities. We're getting abused by the state. What I would say is our current path, and I'll speak to this in a few minutes, is not sustainable even for the most successful entrepreneurial public universities, like the University of California. Great case in point. So let me talk a little bit about the need to rebalance our path, and then I'll get into detailing these trends a little bit more. So in my view, we need to, it's not either or questions, it's a balance question. We have some trend lines that we've been following for 25 or 30 years. I think we just need, on the margins, to shift some of those trend lines in other directions. It doesn't mean to slash some activities, it just means rebalancing what we're doing. And one of those rebalancing activities has to do with more fully serving the public good, more than paying primary attention to our own organizational aspirations for higher rankings. At my own institution, Arizona, we're fixated on becoming a top 10 public research university. I'm not sure how life is going to be so much more wonderful than it is now that we're top 15, but there are some folks, including some faculty, who are deeply committed to this idea, to this aspiration, which, in my judgment, is going to be most achievable if we purchase a lot of dynamite and blow up about five other public research universities. That's our best prospect for attaining this goal. We're in a low-income state. We have very little industry to support either engineering or biotechnology as important fields in Arizona. We're basically a state of developers. Seriously, that's a major industry. That's our major private sector. A little bit of healthcare, of course, as well. But we just don't have the kind of base that's going to catapult us to that level. We're not like Texas A&M or UT Austin with oil revenues, for example, which over the past 50 years has made a huge difference in moving them from being cow colleges, literally, to major international public research universities. We have these sort of aspirations, which I think if we were counseling individuals on an individual level, we'd say, you know, don't get so caught up in keeping up with the Joneses and with what you're not. Be what you are and be good at it. We tend not to give that counsel to ourselves in our kind of professional lives. Second rebalancing is the value of an independent faculty voice, not just in our academic work, but in governance. I think now more than ever we need a faculty voice and the voice of other constituencies on campus, graduate students, staff, to recenter our priorities on education and our service to the communities and the regions in which we're situated. And I think fundamentally we need, on balance, and I'll say a little more about this later, to reinvest in our intellectual capital. You think about faculty members are the intellectual capital of a college or university. We create the value. We create the research. We, through our students, create human capital, augment human capital, so use all this language in the market. We generate grant revenues. None of that stuff happens without us. And our resource, we as a resource, are being depleted in ways that are actually much more dramatic than our economic situation, which the administrations nationally pay far more attention to than to our sort of demographic situation as a professional workforce. So let me say a little bit about corporatization. The current path, which I would say is a corporatization of management. From about 30 years ago, there's a classic book written by George Keller, wonderful scholar, in 1983, called Academic Strategy, The Management Revolution in Higher Education, and was sort of the beginning of administrations becoming more aggressive in having a sense that they needed to more actively steer and manage strategically colleges and universities. Another time period of tough financial times, as I said, books coming out about reduction, reallocation, retrenchment. And part of the storyline of George Keller was, we need to have more effective decision-making structures at the central level. Let's not get rid of Senates, but we need to set up some big ideas committees, joint big ideas committees. This is his language. And actually what he's talked about has come to fruition. So as I said, you have a strategic planning committee. When I, about 10 years ago now, maybe 15 years ago actually, at the University of Arizona, I was an elected faculty member on the Strategic Planning and Budget Advisory Committee, which was advisory to the provost, not a faculty senate committee, but a committee set up by the provost with, I have to say, much more faculty representation than your committee has, but still, advisory to the provost. That's a common pattern nationally. Not eliminating senates, although we're investigating a university RPI that has eliminated a senate. But for the most part, it's sort of doing end runs. Second, there's this new model of management that involves a new structure of employment. So over the past, there's probably not a faculty member on campus who won't tell you a story about when they started here, there were far fewer VPs and vice provosts and the like. Well, it turns out there's a kernel of truth in observation. In fact, more than a kernel. So if you simply go to national data, NCES data, National Center for Education Statistics data, and go from 75 to 2005, you'll see that there's been an increase in that time period in academic employment, in academics, of 17%. If you look at the category of administrator, executive, manager, which is sort of dean and above, the increase is 101%. A little bit of a differential. If you look at non-academic professionals, that's Chenhua, Al Jamieson, people in advising, people in teaching and learning centers, people in development offices, people in sponsored projects, people in technology management. That increase, and those are all Kelly and I's students in higher education programs, the increase is 281%. That's a fundamental change in the structure of professional employment in higher education, for better or worse. I'm going to suggest that we need to rebalance it a bit. Not that it's horrible, not that these people aren't doing important work, not that these people aren't really hardworking, but that it's time to shift the balance back in terms of how we're doing our hiring. And so I mentioned a few times the strategic planning committee. Actually, I need to recalculate it. 17 administrators and two faculty. Two students, one graduate, one undergraduate. One classified staff and one person representing administrative professional staff. If I go to your website, you get a pretty good institutional research website. So bravo to Chenhua and others. And I look at the number of faculty from 2000 to 2008. I see roughly, the site also has headcount. I see an increase of roughly, these are, you know, for the sake of PowerPoint, rough calculations, an increase of about 300. About 1,970-something to about 2,200-something. If I look at, unfortunately, there's a combination of these two categories, administrator and non-academic professional. I see from a base of 800-something an increase of 700 to about 1,500-something. Now, again, every one of those people undoubtedly is doing important work. I'm simply going to submit that at this point in time, it's time to shift that ratio back a little in the other direction. Okay? So this isn't about trashing occupations or individuals. It's about the structure of employment and what we need as we move forward over the next 10 or 15 years. And then I'll say a little bit more about fiscal transparency subsequently. Well, maybe I'll say it now. So one of the things that we've been doing a lot nationally is calling for, if we're going to address our current financial situation, It's always useful to have the full financial situation of information available in a timely fashion and in a form that is something other than, you know, piles and piles of data that we have a hard time wading through. So there's some basic data that we're providing, trying to provide faculty members with and chapters and units with. And a couple of our leaders, one's an accounting professor, Howard Munsis, and another is an economist, Rudy Fichtenbaum. They'll do institutional analyses of the finances of various institutions. The storyline goes pretty much like this. In most states, the discourse of public university leaders is the state economy is in a terrible situation. We're looking at a significant cut. We got a really, you know, we got a dramatic crisis for the institution. We got to make some vertical cuts. That's the language now. Vertical cuts. When I go from place to place and ask, in most places I know, what proportion of your budget comes from the state? After 25 years of privatization, the answer in most public research universities is somewhere between 10 and 30% or so. You're at the high end. You're, I think, close to a third of your budget coming from the state appropriation. And then I'll say, well, for example, I was at University of Rhode Island. They're looking at furloughs, and they say, we're, you know, getting a cut from the state, 10% cut from the state. It's terrible. We're going to have to furlough faculty. I said, what proportion of your budget is from the state? 10%. I said, your tuition's going up, right? I said, yeah. How much? About 9%. What proportion of your budget is from tuition? 33%. Well, tuition money is fairly fungible. In fact, it's extraordinarily fungible. You could move it from one activity to another. So in the case of the University of Rhode Island, I think I would submit they are not even close to being in a financial crisis. Your situation's a little different. You got a much higher proportion of your overall budget coming from state appropriation. But I would still submit that a 10% cut from the state on a 33% proportion of your budget, when you're increasing tuition 14%, and I don't know exactly what the proportion of tuition is, but I'll bet it's over 20% of your budget, plus an increase in a variety of other revenue streams, does not a fiscal crisis make? Do you need to seriously examine your finances and talk about reallocating internally among and resetting your priorities? Absolutely. Does this institution, like most public universities nationally, need more resources from the state? Absolutely. Has your funding from the state gone down in per capita terms, like per student, and in relative terms as a share of the state budget? So the state now pays more for prisons and for Medicaid and the like than for higher education? Absolutely. Does that make a crisis in your budget and mean that your finances are so dire that you need to be laying people off? The answer, again, is absolutely not. That's the argument financially that we're making around the country, and we're trying to put stuff on the table that are alternatives. That whatever financial challenges you're facing, even if two-thirds of your budget is on the academic affairs side of the house, A good portion of that is not academic cost, it's administrative cost. There's a lot of administrative cost in the academic units, in colleges, and even in the departments. And B, you should be considering cuts first in a variety of non-academic parts of the institution, and faculty members ought to be part of, and the Senate ought to be part of that discussion. You should be paying attention to athletic expenditures, which, on average, as Ken was telling me, as a member of that of a committee that deals with that, on average nationally was, what, $8 million a year subsidy for athletic departments from the general budget of the institution. I love college athletics. I went to UCLA. John Wooden was the coach when I was at UCLA. I love going to the basketball game. But you know what? In the midst of this financial time, maybe you don't just rush and hire an athletic director at a high price. I don't know. I'm kind of crazy that way. I think maybe you don't do that. Maybe you put a hold on that. Maybe you rebalance just a little bit. You don't slash it. You don't eliminate it. You don't do away with it. But you say it's time to rebalance. That's the kind of conversation we're trying to promote nationally. not to belittle or deride the value of any part of the institution, but to say we're out of balance and we need to rebalance our priorities. There's another path currently that I think is highly problematic, and that is one of the way that we think about what our objectives are in the work that we do, and it's a path of commercialization. We have this sort of inwardly focused logic that has to do with the status of the university and aspirations for short-term revenues, rather than other logics that have more to do with what's good for our students, what's important for us serving the regions and the communities in which we're situated. In my own university, a fixation on, as I said, the University of Arizona wants to be a top 10. ASU, which is our sister institution in the population center and in the capital of Arizona, they don't want AU status, but they want to keep moving up in the, well, they do want it, but they want to keep moving up in U.S. News and World Report rankings. And the president there, who's a really smart guy, Michael Crow, has as part of his package an incentive movement up pays in terms of bonuses. Now, I would submit to you that in this, the most dramatic economic crisis broadly in arguably 80 years, the population of Arizona probably doesn't care that much about whether ASU is ranked number 124th or number 121st, which they were a year ago. That probably doesn't make a lot of difference to them. What makes more difference to them is what is ASU doing for their kids and for the culture of the region, for the economy of the region. The same thing with the University of Arizona. I don't think it really matters to the average person in Arizona whether we're a top 10 or a top 15. What would matter is if we really devoted ourselves as a university to revitalizing the borderlands, because we're in the borderlands. We're 60 kilometers from the border. We are the borderlands of the U.S. That would be a contribution that the average citizen and even non-citizens in Arizona and nationally could care a lot about. But when we have this inwardly focused logic of we're this individual institution, we're trying to maximize our status, we're chasing status, we lose sight of what we're about as a public land-grant university, which you are as well. So the second thing I'd say about this is how this logic plays out in cuts internally, programmatic cuts. There's a really nice article done by a guy named Peter Eckel, who actually runs programs for the American Council on Education for new provosts. I don't know if your new provost has been there. Mine hasn't. I wish she would go. I'm not sure it would help, but I still wish she would go. And Peter wrote this article based on case studies that he did at a variety of universities about how program cuts are done. Now, the ideal is you go through a process. So you had the academic affairs program prioritization, the A2B2. Great time. At my institution, it was called the Program for the Assessment of Institutional Priorities, PAPE. Now, if you're really clever, which academics are, then you can imagine that the women on campus characterized it as a pap smear. I'm not sure how accurate it was. There's a lot of debate about the value of when you have it and how to interpret it and the like, right? But what Peter Eckel found was, in these case studies, the ideal is you go through one of those processes, you develop criteria, objective criteria in which to evaluate the programs, you get some basic agreement, you do those evaluations, and then that should lead to some decisions. And your decisions should have that sort of decision rationality to them. The decision should be based on the logic of those criteria. But what he found consistently was that that logic was violated in these processes. The data were gathered, the assessments were made, faculty spent lots of time taking it very seriously, trying to do these evaluations, generating their own self-reports, because that's part of these processes generally. I think it was here too. And then at the end of it all, something else seems to take hold. Some other logic takes hold. Now, there's two sort of views about this logic. One is Peter Eckel's logic, and the other one is the logic that a co-author of mine, Sheila Slaughter, who wrote Academic Capitalism, her view of the logic. Peter's view of the logic is it's a political rationality that decides and drives decision-making. And it's this process in a lot of these institutions is each sort of college offers up a sacrifice. And so the political rationality is who doesn't really fit and who do we think we can get away with cutting without creating the most pushback. We don't want to, you know, we don't want to have a lot of bad press. We don't want to get a lot of obstacles and resistance. So who can we, so what ends up getting cut a lot of times is relatively small programs that don't in some way fit. In my own institution, there was a library science program, and it still exists because they successfully fought this. Very successful master's degree program, extremely successful with graduating at the master's level Native American and Latino students, which is not a general characteristic of our master programs nationally or even at Arizona. Well thought of nationally, but it was in a school of social and behavioral scientists. Social and behavioral sciences. And so you get psychologists, sociologists, political scientists, and they're all thinking, well, who do we offer up for a sacrifice? And we got to make that 10% cut. Who do we cut? Let's see. Anyway, you can't have an SBS college without sociology. Maybe you could combine sociology and anthropology, but you know, we got to have those. Can't imagine one without psychology. What is this thing called library science? Library and information science. Is that like people with buns in the back? And, you know, what is that? There's a gender dimension to it, as part of what I'm suggesting. Mm-hmm. And that's what Sheila Slaughter argues. It's this issue of who do we see as close to the market and who do we construct as more or less productive? And gender is not unrelated to that. Ed schools are often on the cutting block. Social work's often on the cutting block. Sort of welfare state functions. Even though they're often highly productive of revenue. They don't cost a lot. They have a lot of students. Their students aren't fully funded. So they're actually generating net tuition revenue. But we tend not to think about that revenue in research universities. We're focused only on how much money do they bring in. So there's a real problem in those kinds of logics driving these processes rather than the logics that we apply as academics. About the quality of the program, the promise and the potential of the program, and the like. And then I think the third thing I'd say is there's this wannabe logic in which we're trying to imitate aspirational peers. So I looked at your peers on your website, and there's some. Anybody know who your peers are? If I was to ask you to name
the list,
it's University of Illinois.
Yeah, that's one. So you got Urbana-Champaign on there, and I got to say, you know, UCLA is on our list, and I would say, well, that's not an aspirational peer; that's an in your dreams peer. It's going to happen for the U of A. And I think I'd probably say the same for you about Urbana-Champaign. And another one on there is Madison. You got North Carolina, that's another. Texas A&M, well, if you get the oil money, maybe. But then you got Mississippi State and Tennessee. That might be, maybe that's looking a little low.
Land-grant universities with vet school.
Yeah.
So our definition.
You have to have a vet school.
Got to have the vet school. Well, your aspirational peers are obviously the AAU universities. Those 54 special folks who, all the faculty in those institutions are happy.
Well,
all the states are really pleased with, you know. We're driven by benchmarking ourselves against what they do. Oh, we can't do that here anymore because they don't do that at AAU institutions. Oh, we need to do this combination because that's what most AAU institutions do. Got nothing to do with you, it's got to do with your aspiration. That's what we're in the midst of. You can't see that, that's a bunch of sheep. So we talk about, and I'm in the midst of a book, well, I'm trying to be in the midst of a book right now, which is about how we do strategic planning in the U.S., in colleges and universities. And for the most part, I really believe that our focus is on, we do this benchmarking, we identify who we want to be like, and then we try, and so we all have biotech and nanotech initiatives. even though our abilities really to capitalize and have comparative advantage in those areas varies dramatically. So at my own university, we have, of course, a biotech initiative. We're not particularly strong in the areas of engineering that are essential to a biotech initiative. We are fabulous in optical sciences and environmental sciences, and we're in the borderlands. And we're great in hydrology. And we have a lot of social sciences and humanities that are good, Latin American studies, linguistics. We could really be fabulous in that kind of a niche. But instead, we chase the same niche as UC San Diego and UCLA. And we don't have a prayer, because we have neither the internal resources nor the external support. So Arizona as a state generated $20 million to support our initiative. The city of San Diego, for UC San Diego, generated $200 million. We're playing a losing game. So I think we need to go from this benchmarking to this. We need to be more creative and strategic in our imagination about what we could be. Because, and I'm using this picture because when I was on that strategic planning committee, we had a provost who, at one of the meetings, said, the deal is we all need to be on the same page, playing the same music. This guy was usually given to military metaphors. This time it was a musical metaphor. So all on the same page, playing the same music, and I'm the conductor. And so we had a new president. I kind of chuckled at the time, and I said, well, that's an interesting view of classical music. I'm not sure if Itzhak Perlman holds to that or other great soloists. But let me just say you got the wrong metaphor, because universities are not symphonies. They're jam sessions of jazz musicians. And we're playing instruments that you don't understand. And we were playing long before you came. And we're going to be here long after you leave. So the game is for you to facilitate our playing, not for you to dictate. A university should never play according to script. We don't do that in our fields. We don't do that in our classrooms. Why in the hell would we do it in our planning? That's where I think we're losing in these strategic planning processes. We're getting into these benchmarking games, adopting the same strategies, the same sorts of criteria that every other institution that we want to be like is doing. The results, and I'm going to sort of rush through some of this because I want to leave a good audience, so I want to hear what you have to say. The results are nationally, this is what your AAU institutions are giving to you. There's a report done in 2006 by a group called the Education Trust. And the title kind of says it all. It's an analysis of patterns of access in flagship universities in each of the states of the Union. So the title is Engines of Inequality. The subtitle is Diminishing Equity in the Nation's Premier Public Universities. So it tracks access, as I say, for underrepresented minorities and for low-income students. Basically, the story it tells is a pretty horrific story from the standpoint of it's not just social justice, because when you're chasing, and I'll get to this in the third bullet, when you're chasing wealthier students, it doesn't mean you're chasing really smart, wealthy students. You may chase them, but you generally don't get them. So your quality scores on your students have not increased over the past several years by our website. The same is true at my institution. We go very aggressive on enrollment management, but actually the average test scores, and I know they're problematic, but let's just use them for a minute, have not gone up over the past 5 years. What's gone up is the socioeconomic profile of our students. And in fact, the test scores of the out-of-state students, and you're beginning to increase your out-of-state students, which is predictable, they pay higher tuition, you want more net tuition revenue, is going down. Why? Well, in my case, in the University of Arizona, it's because the university increasingly is chasing students in Marin County who couldn't get into UCLA and Berkeley and UC San Diego. We give them a $1,000 tuition discount, and we net $13,000, because our out-of-state tuition is about $14,000 or $15,000. If we go after an in-state student, and this is the language we use, we see the in-state low-income student as being expensive. because they only pay $5,000 or $6,000, and your tuition's pretty low too. It's, I think it's roughly around for undergraduates, isn't it? $6,000 or so. Then you got to give financial aid, so you're not netting much at all. In fact, you might even, in some cases, be losing. And so you start doing these calculations that lead you to prioritize relatively modestly scoring upper SES kids over rural and low-income kids who are higher scoring and who are in-state. Is it any wonder that the state is not enamored of giving us money when we strategically manage our enrollments in precisely this way? We have the census tracts, and we target our materials according to the household income of the census tracts, because we're trying to recruit wealthier students who will pay more, who will stay in more expensive dorms, whose parents will be bigger and bigger donors. And when we do that, what do we have to do as institutions? We have to provide the facilities to attract them. So we do things like we build new rec centers with pools in the shape of the state of Washington. That's pretty cool. I swim every day. I'd kind of like to have a pool in the shape of the state of Arizona. I don't know about some states. I don't think I'd want it in the shape of some states. But, you know, Washington is workable. Places I visited in Ohio, two of the institutions in Ohio have lazy rivers in their rec centers. So we're investing a lot, in fact, in facilities. And as I'll get to in a minute, we're not investing that much in faculties. Okay, I'm going to skip this. And I'm going to just say this path, I think, is unsustainable in a variety of ways. First, we have a public that is quite upset about, so we'll drop down to the fifth bullet, about how affordable we are. The Secretary of Education and the Bush administration, the last one, Margaret Spellings, you may take issue with a lot of aspects of her report, but she identified key issues that the public is upset about and concerned about, and that policymakers are concerned about. And one of them is affordability, cost, access and affordability and accountability. When you look at the rate of our tuition increases and compare that to the cost of living, consumer price index or cost of living increases, you can see why, for the public, why is tuition going up so much? What is going on here? Why are we having to pay more and more? It's not sustainable. And even when you increase your tuition as much as you do, you're a low tuition place. You're always going to be in the lower quartiles of tuition among public research universities. You're never going to catch up to being like a Michigan or a Virginia. Not that you should want that, because they're shooting their tuition up too. That, I think, is not only unsustainable, it's undesirable socially and for the region. And I think we're seeing declining public support in part as a function of that. There's some interesting survey data out recently on how well the general public thinks college and universities are run, and the answer is not very well. I actually think we need to emphasize more our public role and gain public support, and I think I'll talk about this more in discussion. Let me just hit this notion of faculties more than facilities. Again, it's not that facilities aren't great. Many universities not only have needed to upgrade their facilities, they continue to be short on classroom space, research space, faculty office space. I don't know if your place is this way, but I know in our place, and in many places nationally, that continues to be a problem. But we've had a period of time when we've invested more in the facilities than in faculties. And I think we need to rebalance that. And when we have the kind of age profile that we have, we begin to realize that on an institutional basis, at my own institution, we have about 1,600 tenure-track faculty. The Human Resource Office of the University of Arizona ran an analysis a couple years ago, and it'll be a little different with the stock market, but their estimate was in the next 10 years, one-third of those faculty are going to retire. Close to one-third will retire. If you do a combination of retiring and leaving, a third will leave. We need to replace a third of the faculty. The numbers are even higher in the sciences, because we're a little science-heavy, probably not unlike you. you start calculating, what does that mean for the startup costs? What are the startup costs for a new bench scientist in molecular biology? Really high. You start thinking about 500 to 600 to 700 faculty being replaced, or 400 maybe in your case. That's, you need to plan for that. And you need to think about the next time you take some money for a building that you're going to have to match the support of, and that you're going to have to pay the upkeep of. You might want to think, who are we going to put in that building? Are we going to have any money to hire the people who are actually going to be doing the teaching and doing the research in those buildings? What's remarkable is we have this problem nationally, even in the fields that some folks on campus see as sort of privileged. STEM fields, which get talked about a lot nationally. I'd like to talk more about source fields, like you can't have STEM without sources. Social sciences, humanities, arts, caring professions. But let's just stick with the STEM fields. Even in the STEM fields, new faculty positions have not been increasing at the necessary rate, I would say. And here's sort of two factoids to speak to that. One has to do with what's sort of become common language now, postdoc purgatory, or perm docs. So when I came out of graduate school oh so many years ago, a postdoc was a step to a tenure track position. You got a good postdoc, you got a good position. It's very typical now for people, even in the sciences, to have 2, even 3 postdocs, to be in their late 30s, early 40s, still in a postdoc. There are not enough positions, full-time tenure track positions, for that talent to be fully taken advantage of and for us to benefit from that talent. That's the first factoid. The second is, just in the life sciences, the average age now of a first-time recipient of an NIH grant is 45. That's the first time. What that tells you is we are moving further and further away from younger faculty being able to succeed in these fields and find positions in these fields. And as a long-term prospect for the academy and for the country, that is not a good profile. Last thing I want to talk about is speech, since we're, you know, this is about shared governance, advancing the public good, faculty having more of an independent voice. How do we engage in this speech about institutional matters when increasingly there are court decisions and some evidence nationally that faculty who speak out may be at some risk? And I think it's not unusual for me to go to campuses where people say, you know, we're kind of interested in that talk you were giving, but we're a little nervous about going to, you know, some session where people are talking about taking charge and taking the lead and voicing their views. And we're kind of worried if we speak out about this plan that the provost or dean has put forward, that if we're not on the train, we're going to be on the track. Is that a phrase that you've heard here? Heard it elsewhere. And I have to say that if you're in a university and you are not free to voice your opinion, you need to help reshape the university that you're in. Because if I were to say in your classroom people are not free to voice their opinion, you'd say, we got to stop that crap. If I were to say in your field of work you're not free to voice and identify problems in the data, alternative ways of thinking about things, I'd say, well, I don't know what kind of field you're in, but you might want to either change the field or get out. I'd say the same thing about our discussions about where we're going as an institution. We're a university. You're supposed to have different views voiced freely. Nobody should be saying to you, as I've heard at some campuses, you're either on or you're off. You're either with us or you're against us. If you oppose us, the train's left the station and there will be blood on the ground. These are not metaphors, discourses that belong in a university. They're also just managerially ill-advised. Faculty are actually pretty smart people, and just about everywhere I go, the faculty are not opposed to doing anything. They just like to have a voice, and you know, sometimes they actually have some ideas about where the place could go that could inform and enhance the strategic plans. Garcetti is a case. Anybody in here heard of Garcetti? Well, that's trouble. Garcetti is a district a person in a district attorney's office who was reprimanded and transferred because he had criticized the handling of a case really in the public interest. So in a sense, he was a whistleblower. And it went to the court, Supreme Court. He was trying to defend himself on the basis of his First Amendment rights, and the court said, nah, when public employees speak pursuant to their official duties, they're not protected by the First Amendment. But the court then, thankfully for us, said expression related to academic scholarship or classroom instruction may have either more constitutional protection or have this sort of other recognition of another standard historically in academia. What we're seeing, though, so if you go to our website, this is one of the things that we do as an association, we have this Speak Up, Speak Out campaign. We have a list of the cases that have percolated now into higher education law in which faculty members are being disciplined for speaking out, and the response is, well, you're an employee and you're in the course of your duties, and your speech about this stuff is not protected. It's not like teaching in your classroom. It's not like doing your research. It's not like talking about climate change. Speech about institutional matters, we don't think necessarily is protected. So what we are pushing is changes in AAU institutions. So here's a lever point for you. To promote this kind of language, to ensure that faculty are free to speak about institutional matters and not worry about being disciplined or retaliated against. So let me give a couple of examples. I've done an analysis of AAU institutions. There's really only two that I have found that protect this kind of speech. What is more typical is, as in your language, which is good language, you invoke the AUP, you talk about speech in classroom instruction, speech in research, extramural speech, but don't focus on speech about institutional matters. So the first place to change this, we were working with the University of Minnesota, AAU institution, you ought to want to be like this. So benchmark on this. So they have the language about research, about teaching, about extramural speech, and then they say, and to speak or write without institutional discipline or restraint on matters of public concern, as well as on matters related to professional duties and the functioning of the university. We did a report and suggested somewhat similar language, but a little variation, to address any matter of institutional policy or action, whether or not as a member of an agency of institutional governance. So you don't have to be a member of the Senate, you don't have to be on a curriculum committee, you don't have to be on a promotion and tenure committee. You can write an op-ed piece, you can be emailing to a colleague, you can be standing up in a meeting and speaking about it. That speech ought to be protected. It's a university. We're about the exchange of ideas, open exchange of ideas, and out of our exchange of ideas come better ideas. There are two other places that are in progress now. University of Michigan, another AAU, has a whole new section on freedom of internal criticism. So it's not even just speech about it, it's criticism of institutional policies. And then the University of California is in progress as well, and I'm pretty sure at Minnesota, the Board of Regents has approved this. I'm pretty confident that at both Michigan and the University of California, some pretty strong version of this will be adopted by the board. So this just isn't what the faculty are proposing. It's really what I think is going to be adopted by the board. So at California, it's the freedom to address any matter of institutional policy or action, whether or not as a member of an agency of institutional governance. And you see the parallelism between this language and what we're recommending, because we're working with these folks. So I think that kind of involvement as academics is absolutely essential in various academic initiatives, in shaping the strategic direction of the institution. And so what I want to close with is, why am I so hung up on this idea of an independent faculty voice? One of the things that for years faculty have gotten hammered for is the idea that we are not loyal enough to the institution. And I think that's an absolutely accurate critique, that we have loyalty to our disciplines, to our profession, to our students, to our responsibility to each of those. That's actually, as it turns out in my view, a good thing for the public and a good thing for the students, particularly in the context that we're currently in, where institutions are focused more and more on short-term gains that have less and less to do with the interests of the students or of the communities in which they're situated. So my concern as a faculty member when my program is being reorganized and eliminated isn't to make the university look good. My concern is, what do we tell the students? How do we communicate to future and current students? What is my responsibility as a professional to the students I serve to talk to them about what the issues are, what their choices are, and what some of their decisions might be, given that we've just stopped admitting students into this program? My loyalty is not to the good public image of the university. My loyalty is to the good education of my students. Similarly, when I'm recruiting students, my loyalty is not, oh, I need to get this person because we need to make money off this person, or we need to increase our prestige. My loyalty is, what's the best place for this student to go? It might be here, or if it happens to be that they're interested in UCLA and I have some knowledge of that program and I know that that's actually a better fit for them, I want them to go there and I'll tell them that. That's my loyalty. And that's why our independent voice is so important. We're not just employees of this institution. We are guardians of a public interest. And that interest serves the students and it serves the larger community. I think we need to go about shaping Senate language, and we've had some conversations earlier today about the role of the Senate and the sort of foundation that different institutions have for a weaker or stronger Senate. I think you're actually in a pretty good place compared to my institution, where the provost and president are not just on the Senate, they're voting members and they kind of direct things oftentimes. I think we also need to change our own discourse, because a lot of what we do is to buy into, many of us buy into these processes. When we're doing reorganization, we think, well, we can always cut them. They're not quite as strong as we are. We're pretty good at slicing and dicing each other. In my institution and many others, phrases I've heard are things like, well, there's always low-hanging fruit we can get rid of. About 2 years ago, before I took this job, we were in the midst of this discussion as an institution. One of the people who'd been in a previous series of cuts reminded us that in that exchange, in the exchanges about reorganizing at that time, somebody had said about his program and others, and this was a faculty member, this was not an administrator, had said, what we need to do is shoot the wounded. That's a nice image, isn't it? We don't have enough resources as an institution to support the wounded. Let's shoot them. So I think we have some internal work to do about how we, treat each other and how we frame these kinds of decision-making processes. I think we need to be part of choosing the story about this institution in the future. It doesn't just have to be a story about rankings, like moving you to a new level of excellence. It can be a story about what is the purpose of the work that you're doing. What is your role as a land-grant institution? What is special about you in Eastern Washington? That path isn't inexorable with regard to budget cuts, with regard to program priorities, and an independent faculty voice is absolutely essential to actually making that saga stick. Otherwise, it will become a laughingstock phrase that faculty and others refer to years down the road. At my institution, when I first started in the late 80s, it was announced to us that this was the year of the undergraduate. We were going to become a student-centered research university. There were napkins printed, there were pencils printed, there were banners all over the place. We didn't do the podiums the way I've seen some podiums around here with your moniker. But we did a lot of promotion around this, and it was a laughingstock. Because at the very same time we were promoting all this stuff, we were increasing class sizes, we were reducing resources for instruction, we were doing a whole variety of things that demonstrated this was not a student-centered research university. The same thing is true here. I would guess, knowing faculty as I do, that you have a lot of ways of playing with the phrase
world-class face-to-face. That's not, you have the story to tell about this place. Not some marketing firm they hired. You have the story to tell about this place. Not a president who's new to the place in relative terms and who, by the accounts of the average tenure of presidents, will be moving on within 3 or 4 or 5 years. You tell the story of the place. And that's why an independent faculty voice, in my view, is so important to the institution. Not just because we can be sort of the conscience of the place and focus us on education, but because we actually understand the place and are committed to it and live in it and want to stay in it. And so I'll stop with that. Thanks for your patience. If you've got the energy, I'm happy to take questions. For like a long class, I've just beaten you into submission.
Yeah, there's a question right there.
Okay.
At the very beginning, you were giving us some interesting numbers, 1975 to 2005, increase in faculty, increase in higher administration, increase in non-academic administrators. Now, you were giving that as percentage increases, but percentage increase off what base?
Right. Yeah, if there were only 5 administrators at the beginning of the gathering of the data, you're right. The numbers for your institution, as you saw, or as I read off to you, for full-time equivalent faculty versus full-time equivalent administrators